professor at Wheaton College and moderator for this session, Probing the Past, Contributions from Paleontology and Archaeology. If you're in the field of paleontology or archaeology, you know that they share a lot of common methodologies, even common questions, just sometimes separated in time by quite a bit. You also know, if you're in paleontology or archaeology, how confused the public is. If you're a paleontologist, you're often asked about, you know, arrowheads. And if you're an archaeologist, you're sometimes asked about dinosaur bones. And so we're just going to make the confusion even greater this morning by putting the two disciplines in the same session. We're going to move from a paleontological talk into some talks which are probably more archaeological in theme. As a geologist, I've kind of moved from both areas and found that there's quite an emerging field of geoarchaeology, and so that will figure in some of the talks that we hear today. And our first speaker is Keith Miller. You met him last night as he moderated the wonderful session we had with Mary on dinosaur research. So to present the first talk, I'd like to introduce to you Keith Miller.
Well, again, welcome. And gee, everyone is at least on this side of the room, kind of. Title of my talk is Study of Paleontology and the Creation Mandate. And my intent in this is to try to put the practice of paleontology in a broader kind of creation care context, perhaps. In ways that you may not have thought of previously. First question is, what do I mean here by creation mandate? And what I mean is primarily what it means to express our status as images of God before creation. And I like to think of the image of God as being a verb, as being an active thing. Should be talking about how we image God to the rest of creation. And I see a big part of that is being in exercising servant lordship. And the creation over which we exercise that servant lordship is a very diverse and complex and dynamic system. And furthermore, the diversity, the complexity of the modern biosphere is a consequence of its history. And as soon as we talk about the history of the biosphere, we're necessarily start to talk about paleontology. So what our current biosphere is, the current anatomy of living organisms, their interactions, their behaviors, are all a consequence of their history. Just as us as individuals, what we are as individuals is a consequence of our history. And in a very similar way, what the natural world is, what the biosphere is a consequence of its history. And if we're going to look at the history of the biosphere, again, one of the important disciplines in reconstructing that is paleontology. And one thing that I think is very important to realize is that paleontology is not stamp collecting. It's not about adding another species to our encyclopedia. New discoveries are exciting, they're important, but they're only important in context. Because what we're really about is reconstructing the past, understanding and reconstructing the past. It's not about adding a new cool dinosaur to our list. And how we do that, all about context. And in addition to just the anatomy of ancient organisms, reconstructing their anatomy and their physiology to the best of our ability based on the available evidence, we're also interested in what's the broader context. Where is the fossil found? In time, in space, What do the enclosing sediments and rocks tell us about the environments in which those organisms lived? So when we approach reconstruction of the past, we have to start with the data as it's given to us. Often that data is, you know, a single bone or a small collection of bones or a jaw fragment or a couple teeth if we're talking about vertebrates. But again, in collecting that data, we're interested in not just those specific preserved fossils, but their context. Where are they in time? What is the enclosing sediment like? How are they preserved? What does that tell us about the environment in which those organisms were ultimately preserved? So much of modern paleontology is involved in not just extracting the fossils, but in gathering the context, gathering information about the context of those particular fossils. In some very rare and spectacular cases, we can actually get at species interactions, behavior, directly from the fossil record. Admittedly, these are extraordinarily rare events. Here's some examples of a couple dinosaur life assemblages. On the left, have a case of an oviraptor, a particular bird type, a bird-like dinosaur, which was preserved brooding its eggs underneath its extended arms is a ring of eggs. It was actually preserved sitting on top and brooding its nest of eggs. So we learn a considerable amount about reproductive behavior by this extraordinary fossil, or famous fossil on the right of a velociraptor and a protoceratops kind of locked in a death grip and happened to be preserved in this very spectacular predator-prey interaction. You may know in a lot of the news, particularly in dinosaur paleontology these days, many, many really spectacular discoveries of fossils that preserve some of their external anatomy, in this case, feathers and feather-like structures in this particular small bird-like dinosaur. Again, it gives us a wealth of information not normally available. As we saw yesterday in Mary's talk, we can learn a lot about ancient organisms, extinct organisms, at the microscopic level, even now at the kind of the protein and microstructural level. This is examples of microstructure of bones of different types of dinosaurs, which again can tell us things about growth rate, energetics, that is how warm or stable their internal temperatures were. Really get at a lot of issues or aspects of their biology and physiology. Odd things like fossilized feces called coprolites, which are actually not all that rare, which can tell us things about the digestive biology of organisms, about if they're herbivores, what their preferred plant materials were, or if they're predators, what maybe some of their prey items were, and again, other things about their digestion and other aspects of their biology. Footprints, again, we can learn a lot about behavior, different gaits, walking speeds, running speeds, even some things about community behavior, herding behavior. Other kinds of things can be gleaned from these types of data. So all these tell us things about the anatomy, physiology, behavior of extinct organisms, but we want to extend beyond that to their broader ecological context. In other words, we're not just interested in reconstructing this one cool dinosaur and kind of bringing it back to life, but what was its ecological context? What place did it have in the broader ecosystems? And we can get at this kind of information by not just paying attention to a particular species or type of organism, but rather to the whole breadth of the community. Much of paleontology these days is really focused on reconstructing the complex interactions of organisms. So dinosaur paleontologists aren't just out there trying to find the biggest dinosaur bone anymore, but they'll look at everything: pollen, plant material, invertebrates, vertebrates, trying to get a sense of the broader community, broader terrestrial community. So, for example, in the Cretaceous, these are some examples of fossil Cretaceous plants of various types that would have been contemporaneous with the Cretaceous dinosaurs. What insects were feeding on those plants? What were the insect herbivores? What were the pollinators? How was pollination done? What organisms were the primary pollinators for a very different collection of plants than exist today? What were the other vertebrates? What were the amphibians? What were the mammals? Mammals were contemporaneous with the dinosaurs. What were they like? What was their position in the ecosystem? What roles did they fill? Birds, on the left, some with spectacular preservation of feathers, pterosaurs, for example. So we can put together from all these various sources of information a really pretty impressive reconstruction or picture of the past. So we're not just reconstructing a particular specimen, but we're putting it into context and building up a broader picture of what that environment was like. But now I want to come back to this idea that we don't look at these ecosystems or organisms as static things. They're evolving organisms in an evolving community ecosystem, which is continually responding and adapting to a changing environment. And so creation has a history. These organisms had a history, and we can only really understand them by understanding that history, and that's an evolutionary history. So again, anatomy is shaped by changing environments, and I'm going to illustrate this briefly by looking at a very famous series of fossils, in this case dealing with horses, but you could apply this with many other large herbivores called megafauna. And there are a lot of things that are shaping, for example, what is a horse today? Why is a horse, like, why does it have the anatomy and physiology and behavior that it does? And it's a consequence of a very long historical trajectory, both responding to changing ecosystems, changing climates, changing vegetation that it was responding to, as well as changing predators, what we call an arms race. As predators get more efficient at capturing and tracking down their prey, the prey then has to respond to that and become able to respond and resist the advances of the predators. So you get this kind of positive feedback spiral. And what a horse is today is a consequence of both of those things. So very quickly, many of them, I'm sure you know, there's a number of things, dramatic changes that occurred within the lineage of horses over the last 50, 60 million years, beginning with animals that were browsers in kind of forest environments, then the appearance of the first grasslands or kind of open grasslands. Short grass prairies and then long grass prairies. So the vegetation changed dramatically and the climate changed dramatically over this time. And one of the things that herbivores had to respond to was this changing vegetation, changing from browsing on trees and bushes and shrubs to eating these very coarse, fibrous grasses. And this resulted in their teeth becoming much higher, more complex, able to both process and this coarse plant material and not be ground down very quickly through this coarse abrasion. And also, during this time, was the evolution of whole new groups of predators, which stimulated the development of faster running speeds, being able to flee the fast prey. This resulted in a reduction of number of toes on the feet, in the anatomy of the limbs that enabled them to be much more fleet of foot. So just kind of put that in pictorial fashion, some of the earliest horses in a more forested environment with small predators, not nearly as fast, to evolution of the first grasses, the first short grasses in the early Miocene, grass prairies, kind of open forests. Lower right there are some more active fleet predators, causing these herbivores to need to run faster to escape their prey. Tall grass prairies by the late Miocene, and then vast grasslands, high altitude, low altitude steppes and prairies, cooling climate moving into the ice ages of the Pleistocene with a much more modern looking fauna. So what a horse is today is a consequence of that evolutionary history. Another way to look at this is that we can't really understand some of the aspects or characters of modern organisms, modern ecosystems, without understanding their history. And in fact, some animals and plants are enigmas today, what have been called anachronisms. That is, they don't make any sense. And I'm going to focus here in particularly on some plants that don't make any sense in the current environment. Their adaptations, their morphologies, don't make any sense in the current situation, but they do make sense in an historical context. Some things that are hints of anachronisms in plants are plants that make these really large edible fruits and nothing eats the fruit, that they can't disperse. They have seeds that won't disperse, or they won't germinate. And so these are all anachronisms. Just some examples. Crescentia is a large fruit in South America. These kind of large balloon-like fruits that very few things eat. Nothing really eats. Things like avocados with tasty fruits and very large seeds that nothing today can deal with. There's these enormous big pits or seeds. Osage orange, which people in North America and the plains and east will be familiar with. Pawpaws, desert gourds. These are South American desert gourds. Again, they produce lots of these fruits and nothing eats them. They just sit around and rot. I mean, this doesn't make any sense. The reason plants make fruits is for things to eat them. The reason they have large edible fruits is for there'll be herbivores to eat those fruits and disperse the seeds. If nothing eats the fruits, there's no reason for the investment in the plant to put all that effort into making a fruit if nothing's going to eat it. So these are anachronisms. mesquite, all these great bean pods, but nothing eats the beans. and also, the seeds won't germinate. They're very, very difficult to get germinated. A lot of the honey locust or locust-related plants are the same. very difficult to germinate. You have to scour them, do other things to them. It turns out that if an animal eats them and seeds go through the digestive system of an animal with the acids and abrasion that are in the digestive system, they'll germinate very quickly. They have to be eaten to germinate, but nothing eats them now. Plants on the right that have, you know, all these protective, you know, thorns and things, but nothing eats them. What are you protecting against? Things that have really weird dispersal mechanisms that nothing uses, like devil's claw that has these great hooks that actually do great for wrapping around the feet of large herbivores, but there aren't any large herbivores around to do it. You know, they catch on your ankles and stuff. But you don't have to go back very far, 10,000 years, in some cases a lot less than that. And we have a whole host of extinct megafauna that lived in these places. These are examples of South American megafauna, ground sloths, lipticerns, toxodonts. These were all very large herbivores that probably ate these various types of fruits. But they're extinct. So once they went extinct, these plants had no way to disperse themselves. The animals that they grew up co-evolved with to disperse the seeds no longer exist. Similarly, in North America, mastodons and mammoths, as well as ground sloths and other things that came up from South America, would have had similar kinds of functions. So it's very likely these large fruits, these big seed pods, things like that, were being eaten by these large herbivores. So I think we can take this and say, not only does having this historical perspective help us understand why things are the way they are today, but it informs our creation care. It informs our stewardship of creation. Because we are now big players in modern ecosystems. We are drastically modifying ecosystems. We're causing the extinction of many organisms without knowing what the implications of those changes are. And we're changing things faster than organisms can adapt to. So we're creating a lot of anachronisms by removing pollinators, by removing herbivores, removing predators. We're dramatically changing the ecosystems that these organisms have evolved to over very long periods of time. And last aspect of this, which I put last not because it's less important, is that part of our being the image of God, I think, is expressed in our ability to look into the past, as well as look into the future. And that's a very God-like capability. And in a sense, as we're reconstructing the past, we're looking into things that only God saw. I mean, all the creation that preceded us, you know, the tens and hundreds of millions of years of the history of life, all those past ecosystems, God was the only one that was able to look down and say, it is good, and rejoice in that. But now we can too. As we reconstruct the past, we can participate with God in that. We can bear witness to God's glory and goodness and power. So when we reconstruct a dinosaur diorama, it should be more than, gee, this is cool, from a scientific perspective, but from a Christian perspective, we are kind of time machines looking back and rejoicing and glorying in God's past creation and participating with God and declaring the goodness of his creation. Or whether it's an extinct mammal community. We're doing the same thing. We're reflecting God's character and rejoicing and looking upon what God has made. So in conclusion, as image bearers, we are participants now in the creation. And as such, I think it is incumbent upon us to understand the history of that creation, because what creation is now is a consequence of its history. And the more we can understand that history, the better we can exercise our role as God's stewards. And again, I would argue that paleontology has a crucial role to play in that. Thanks. Okay. Are there any questions? Yes. Actually, I guess I deflect the question in a sense, as I don't think it comes down to individual discoveries, but more attitudes and approach to the problems, which I think has changed and also been consequence of new technologies to enable us to look at things we weren't able to look at before. And that is really this idea of what we're really interested in is reconstructing ecosystems and changing environments. Paleontology has become very interdisciplinary. You probably see that from the talk yesterday. I mean, it's become very, very interdisciplinary. And, you know, you go back 100 years or so, most of the interest was just getting the cool specimen. You know, it was all kind of museum collecting, putting, you know, just the excitement of these discovery of these previously unknown organisms. But we've moved beyond that. I mean, that's what hits the newspaper. That's what's flashy as far as the media is concerned. But as far as the scientific community, it's these interactions. How are things interacting? What how can we reconstruct the whole, you know, panoply of complex interactions of organisms? And what does that mean now? I mean, what does that mean for our living biosphere? And those, I think, questions have really kind of risen to the top in just the last few decades. As far as the plant's concerned, it's the same thing. Because what a plant is concerned about is not just, especially like plants, things that can't walk, disperse, is they have to have a means of getting from one place to another. Things like with big seeds, what happens if nothing eats the fruit just drops around the tree, rots. And if there's any new growth, it's right where the original plant is. So what's happened to these anachronistic plants is they've constricted in their locations. Some have gone down to just very small groves, all that's left. Like ginkgo is a famous example. Until they were rediscovered, there's only one small grove of living trees in the whole world in China. And that they had worldwide distribution for hundreds of millions of years. It's presumably, again, because their dispersal agent was extinct. So for a plant, the reason they invest all that energy in fruit is for something to eat them, so they carry the seeds someplace else. And again, some of these have developed also dependencies on actually those seeds being consumed by the fruit eaters in order for the seeds to germinate. So it's become a very dependent relationship. So as far as the plant's concerned, they want the fruit to get eaten because that's their guarantee. Yeah. That's a big debate that I don't have time to get into, but that's a very open question. And at the moment, a lot of it has to do with timing, precise timing of when human populations moved into these areas versus when the particular groups went extinct, whether they were already in decline for a substantial period of time when human populations were introduced. So there's quite a range of opinion in that regard, and I don't think it's something that's resolved at this point.